Greetings, everyone, and welcome to The Law Hour. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, as an educational service in the public interest. I'm your host, George Gordon. And The Law Hour is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5 over North America, and we're on worldwide on the Internet 7 days a week. Now, for more information about The Law Hour and the Gordon Law School, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay with us for tonight's special report on the national debt right after this message. You know, if you're earning $50,000 a year and you pay all of your 14 taxes, you get to keep 41% of what you create and produce. Government gets 59%. That's about $20,000 for you and $30,000 for the government. Now, isn't that just real special? And if you think your share isn't enough for you, then why don't you work twice as hard, produce twice as much, and make $100,000 next year? Now go ahead and pay your same 14 taxes just like you did this year, and you're going to net 24%, and the government will net 76%, which means that for working twice as hard and producing twice as much, you'll net $4,000 more. That's an 8% net take-home pay increase. For producing 100% more, you get to keep 8% of it. Now, there ought to be something more intelligent for you and I to do than to work to put ourselves into the top 5% of income earners and then only net 24% of it. Why don't you call today and order my free 4-hour CD package and let me tell you how to deal with that kind of crime. It's 4 hours of entertaining information, and it answers many of your legal questions about taxes and why it is that we pay so much for so little received. And let me teach you how to do just that in my Tax and Status School, which is now available on compact disc for adult homeschooling. To order your free general law CD package, you can call direct 417-273-4967. Or if you're online, go to the email and click on to the email machine. The email address, or the website address, I should say, is georgegordon.org. Then click on to the email machine and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. All right, let me do that. And again, that's georgegordon.org. Click on to the email, send an email request, or call direct 417-273-4967. A fellow by the name of Sheldon Emery wrote a small book called Billions for the Bankers and Debts for the People. One of the subjects that he brought up in his book was the national debt. Listen to some of these statistics here, and we'll take a look at money and money policy and our national debt. In 1901, the national debt of the United States was less than $1 billion, and it stayed at less than $1 billion until we got into World War I. Then it jumped to $25 billion. Well, between 1918 and 1941, on the eve of World War II, the national debt just about doubled from $29 to $49 billion. Then between 1942 and 1952, the debt went from $72 billion to $265 billion in 1962. It went up to $303 billion. 8 years later, in 1970, it was $383 billion. Between 1971 and 76, it rose from $409 billion to $631 billion. Then at the end of 1977, it topped $800 billion. During the Reagan years, it topped $1 trillion. Today, in 2004, it tops $7 trillion, and the budget deficit for the 1 year, fiscal year 2004, while projected to be about $550 billion, the real numbers are expected to hit closer to $1 trillion. And that's your national debt, and that's caused by something. Something happened here. In 1900, we had $1 billion worth of debt, and today, 100 years later, we've got a $7 to $8 trillion debt. Money is practically worthless. It's lost 96.5% of its purchasing power. Or put another way, it's lost 96.5 cents of purchasing power over what it had in 1900. Now, that's pretty significant, wouldn't you say? A $20 gold piece or a $20 bill in 1930 would have bought you a Hickey Freeman suit and wingtip shoes with suspenders, shirt, and tie. Today, that same $20 gold piece will buy you that same Hickey Freeman suit, wingtip shoes, suspenders, shirt, and tie. But that $20 bill probably would not buy you the necktie. Now, that's called inflation. Americans today are used to inflation. We were born in inflation. We have been raised through inflation. We participate in inflation. We all know about inflation. We accept it. It's just a part and parcel with doing business and living life. Inflation is a theft. The national debt is a theft. But you can't prosecute people or hold them responsible for thefts if you yourself participate in the theft. Equity's doctrine says that you can't come to equity with dirty hands. So if you're going to come to equity as a participant in the theft itself, then you can't complain that you've been stolen from because you're a part and parcel with it. We say that you're an accessory before the fact, or you're an accessory after the fact, or you may be an accessory both before and after the fact. Now, you do not have to deal in paper money. You can deal in gold and silver. You always have had that option. There was a period of time when everybody dealt in gold and silver as a matter of public policy from 1900 to 1933, and then we dropped gold, and then in 1965 we dropped silver. You could have maintained a gold and silver standard had you desired to, but nobody did. Today we have our gold and silver back. Only 5% of the people in the United States own 100% of the gold and silver that's in circulation. That's pretty significant. 5% of the people have 100% of the gold and silver. The other 95% of the people in the country are landless peasants who do not own any gold or silver. They don't have any money with which to conduct business. Now, they can participate in public business in the national economy, but they can't participate in private business outside of the national economy, and I think that's something worth discussing. Now, there are three types of conquest. History reveals that nations can be conquered by the use of one or more of these three methods. The most common use of conquest is by war. In time, though, this method usually fails because the captives hate the captors and rise up and drive them out if they can. Much force is needed to maintain control and to making it expensive for the conquering nation. Now, a second method is by religion, where men are convinced that they must give their captors part of their earnings as obedience to God. Such a captivity is vulnerable to philosophical exposure and change or by overthrow of armed force, since religion by its very nature lacks military force to regain control once its captives become disillusioned. And the third method can be called economic conquest. It takes place when nations are placed under tribute, without the use of visible force or coercion, so that the victims do not realize that they've been conquered. Tribute is collected from them in the form of legal debts and taxes, and they believe that they're paying it for their own good and for the good of others. Or to protect all from some enemy, their captors become their benefactors and their protectors. Now, if we take a look at the United States today, we Americans send money to Russia. We have given most favored nation or trading nation status to Red China, our former enemies, during the Cold War. And then we were told that we won the Cold War. The Berlin Wall came down. That was the symbol that the Cold War was over and that the Americans won. No, just the opposite is true. You see, the Cold War was an ideological war, not fought with bullets and bayonets. It was fought with economics, propaganda, ideas, politics. It was a war of brainwashing. It was a war of psycho politics. And the Russians and Chinese won the war hands down. And the wisest thing they ever did was to tell the vanquished that they were the victors. And the vanquished are paying to the Chinese and the Russians billions of dollars a year. You see, most favored nation trading status takes $550 billion a year out of America and gives it to the Russians and the Chinese, the Japanese, and a whole host and plethora of others of our enemies, people who have never at any time acceded to our Christian philosophies or our political ideologies. In fact, if you take a look at the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto espoused by the Chinese communists and the Russian communists, we Americans have accepted and practice all 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, such as public schools for all children, or free public education for all children in public schools. And the fifth plank, the central bank, the second plank, the income tax. You see, we've adopted their political ideologies and philosophies, but they have not accepted any of ours, such as the 10 principles of the Bill of Rights, you know, like free speech. You don't have free speech in Israel. You don't have free speech in Russia or China. And you don't have free speech in America. Today we have laws that prohibit hate speech. These are direct attacks on the First Amendment's right to free speech. My point is simply this. The Cold War is over. It's done. The Russians and Chinese won hands down, told us we won, and we're paying them tribute. And that's where the bottom line is. And now we're fighting their proxy war in Iraq. We're over there bleeding. We're over there paying. The Russians and the Chinese are over there collecting. So history reveals that nations can be conquered by the use of one, two, or three different methods: war, religion, or economic conquest. And although this is the slowest to impose, that is economic conquest, it is often quite long-lasting, as the captives do not see any military force arrayed against them. Their religion is left more or less intact, and they have freedom to speak and to travel, and they participate in elections for their rulers. Without realizing it, they've been conquered, and the instruments of their own society are used to transfer their wealth to their captors and make the conquest complete. In 1900, the average American worker paid few taxes and had very little debt. Last year, payments on debts and taxes took more than half of what the average American earns. So is it possible that a form of conquest has been imposed upon our people in America? Well, let's read the following pages, and then I'll let you decide for yourself, and may God have mercy on his once debt-free and great nation, the United States of America. Now, that was a little story told by Sheldon Emery back in 1977. I thought that's a good place for us to start, because when money comes into circulation today, it's borrowed into circulation. That means that you have to sign a promissory note. You go to the bank and you borrow $10,000 because you want to buy a car, you want to buy a big screen TV or a house or something. You sign a promissory note, and you promise to pay interest plus the principal back over a period of time. You become a debt slave. I don't know why you don't wait until you have the money and pay cash so you don't have to pay any interest, but you can't wait, and so you have to have it right now. It's the American way. This money comes into circulation, this $10,000 comes into circulation by simply writing checks. The bank gives you a checking account, hands you a little book, and you got a limit of $10,000, and you go out and write these checks for $10,000. This money came into existence through usury and debt with no labor. Now, the system that God designed is predicated upon thou shalt not steal, and you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. So you have a law that says thou shalt not steal, and then we have a statute prohibiting unjust weights and balances. Just weights and balances deal in property. Property are the tangible products. It can be labor. That's tangible. It can be a cow, a dog, a horse, a tractor, a car. It can be a farm tool. It can be gold or silver, but it's got to be some form of property. Paper money comes into existence in this way. The Federal Reserve orders the Bureau of Engraving and Printing to print up a $1 bill, and it costs 3 cents. So when the Federal Reserve spends it, they make a 97-cent profit. They can take the same 3 cents and have the Bureau of Engraving and Printing print up a $100 bill, a $500 bill, a $1,000 bill, or a $10,000 bill, and it still only costs 3 cents to print it. That's the paper and the ink. It goes into circulation, and the people of the United States become the surety guarantors of that credit in circulation. For instance, how would you like it if I wrote up a promissory note for $10,000 and had you sign it and pay it back while I go out and spend it and enjoy the fruits that come from it? Because that's what the Federal Reserve is doing. The Federal Reserve, in short, prints up these bills, spends them, takes all of the profit, and you get to pay the bill. Worse than that, you get to pay the bill plus interest. It's not a very good business deal. It's not exactly clear why you want to do that, but I suspect that you didn't understand how that game is played. Then, that money that's borrowed in the circulation by your federal government goes on the books as a debt. It's a debt to the Federal Reserve. That $7 trillion of debt that we owe is owed to the same Federal Reserve system. 13 families, 13 stockholders of the Federal Reserve Corporation. Not a very good deal for Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife, but that's because we didn't want to obey God and keep His commandments. Now let me describe how God mandates that money come into circulation. It's very simple. You go out and go to work and dig gold, silver, or you plant wheat, or you create wealth through your labor out of the ground. All wealth comes out of the ground. And you take that wealth that you create and produce out of the ground and you trade it to somebody else, and he gives you something that he has produced out of the ground. A fisherman could go out and catch fish, and you could climb a tree and pick bananas. At the end of the day, he trades you some fish, you trade him some bananas. Now both of you have fish and bananas to eat. Third person comes in and he grows vegetables. At the end of the second day, you've got fish, bananas, and vegetables to trade among yourselves. Your standard of living is going up. Everybody is producing real wealth. At the end of the fourth day, another guy joins the trading club and he produces fruit. Now you've all got fruit, vegetables, bananas, and fish to eat. Then another guy joins up, and maybe he's a carpenter, and he goes out and starts building huts. Now you've all got a hut to live in, bananas to eat, fruit to eat, fish and vegetables to eat, and a hut to live in. Everybody here is producing real substance. Everybody here is prospering. Everybody here is making profit. Everybody here is learning to live better through labor. As we get a little more sophisticated, we might want to put in a monetary system. A monetary system is based upon property. So we have a gold miner comes into the club, and he goes out and digs gold out of the ground. He trades gold, which makes beautiful jewelry, and can also be minted into little round discs and traded for fish, bananas, huts, vegetables, and fruit. The gold miner has now come into the trading group, and he produces something of substance, something that's beautiful, something that's tangible, something that you want, something that you desire, something that you can wear, something that you can use. You can use it in little discs to trade for fish, or you can the guy that takes the little discs for fish can then use it to trade for bananas and so on. Now, another guy comes into the trading group and he's called the banker. The banker comes in and says, you need me in your trading group because I print paper that takes the place of the gold discs. And it gives you a place to store these gold discs because we have thieves that might come in and break up and steal your gold discs. But the banker can make these paper dollars in place of the gold discs with little or no expense. For every gold disc, he can, for 3 cents, make one of those. And if he can persuade us to buy, sell, and trade with these paper notes instead of the actual gold discs, he can trade those worthless pieces of paper for the valuable gold discs, the valuable huts, the valuable fish, the valuable fruits and vegetables, the valuable bananas, and in time, the banker, who produces nothing and consumes much, will ultimately own everything, including us. And that's what happened in America. This is called economic captivity. It happens every time that you use unjust weights and balances. And that's why we have a law in the Bible that says, thou shalt not. Understand? Thou shalt not. Don't do that. You shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. You shall not deal in these paper certificates, stocks and bonds and mortgages and negotiable instruments. And you shall not charge usury. You shall not oppress your brother. The banker charges usury. The banker uses unjust weights and balances. The banker has persuaded us to become thieves. The banker has persuaded us to violate the laws of God. And he tells us that this is the way to get rich. This is the way to prosperity. This is a better system than God created. God requires you to work by the sweat of your brow. God requires sweat and sweaty underarms and effort and toil. And the banker comes along and says, I offer a profession, an air-conditioned office, where you sit at the top of the food chain and the other fools, the lesser people in society, go out and work. But we don't. This creates an aristocracy. This aristocracy in America is called the professional classes. These are the bankers, the lawyers, the psychiatrists and doctors. These are our aristocracy. This is our aristocracy. These people are our masters. They do not work. They do not produce. But they consume much. And they own everything. Now, in order to put gold into circulation in a modern industrial economy, God knew what he was talking about when he said, I'm going to give you all the gold and silver in the hills out there. I'm not going to give you the land. The land shall not be sold forever. But I'm going to give you the chattels. Now, the way that worked, when I was a kid down on Wages Creek in Mendocino County, California, a man could go out in 1900 when our national debt was measured in gold dollars and totaled less than $1 billion of them. He could go out on Wages Creek and work for a day and produce about $1 worth of gold. At the end of the month, he'd have about $30 worth of gold. And he could take that gold down to San Francisco to the mint, and for 1%, he could have it minted into one $20 gold piece and one $10 gold piece and walk out of the mint, and now he's got money. He converted his labor directly into money. He could then take the $20 gold piece and go into John's suit shop and get a Hickey Freeman suit with wingtip shoes, suspenders, and a shirt and tie and socks and walk out of there, and he had worked 20 days, and there was his suit and tie. Now, the banker came along in 1933 in the form of Franklin D. Roosevelt and said, you know, the reason that we have this Great Depression is because of gold. That's what our problem is. Let's abandon gold and let's go to paper money exclusively. And if we do that, the only thing you have to fear is fear itself. Now, the theory behind this is fairly sound. We'll take all the gold and put it in Fort Knox, and then we'll take $20 worth of gold, that's 1 ounce, and we'll issue a $20 bill, and we'll have the gold in the bank, and you can trade with the paper. And as long as we don't issue any more paper than we have gold on deposit, the system works like a shot. And as long as you've got convertibility, that is, any time that we want to trade our paper for the gold and the gold for the paper, we can do that at our option. The economy works, and it works like a shot. Now, the only purpose for paper is to steal. You see, we don't need paper if we don't intend to steal. If you come here to my farm and you say to me you want to buy a cow, and I say, well, I want 4 ounces or 5 ounces of gold for that cow, and you give me the 5 ounces of gold, and you take the cow, my inventory remains the same. It has changed from cows and gold to cows and gold, but I have fewer cows by one, and I have more gold by 5 ounces. But when you come and write me a check, and you take my cow, now you have my cow, and I have your check, and your check is worth exactly nothing, unless I can take your check and convert it into a horse, which now will replace my cow with a horse. Now my inventory balances. And then that check goes back to the maker, and then what did he have in the bank that represents that horse? Well, the answer is nothing. So let's suppose that I've got 10 cows and you've got 10 horses. And you come over and you trade me one cow for one horse. And now you've got 9 horses and one cow, and I've got 9 cows and one horse. Now, assuming that the banker comes along and he offers to give you money, that is his money, our economy is made up of 10 horses and 10 cows. Now the banker comes along and inflates the economy. It's now got 10 horses, 10 cows, and it's got $10,000. Now the banker writes a check and takes a horse from you, and he writes me a check and takes a cow from me. Now our economy is 9 horses, 9 cows, and 2 checks. The banker has walked off with one horse and one cow and paid absolutely nothing for it, unless, of course, you value those checks. If you value those $1,000 as one cow and one horse, I think we'd be better off in our economy if I've got 10 cows and you've got 10 horses, and the banker wants to join our economy. We require the banker to come in with 10 somethings that are worth what our 10 cows and 10 horses are worth. He might come in with, something on the order of 50 sheep. 50 sheep being worth 10 cows or 10 horses. But the banker doesn't come in with anything. In fact, the banking institutions of the United States, if they went to the Small Business Administration to borrow money, they couldn't borrow any money under the rules, because to borrow money from the SBA, you must have liquidity equal to 50% of the value of your business. In other words, you've got to have a 50% ownership in your business. The banks only own 5% or less. In other words, they're only capitalized at 5%. They got 95% debt and 5% assets. Now, in my business operation, I have 100% assets and zero debt. Now, the banker comes to me and he says, well, Gordon, what I'd like to do is to lend you money. Now, if the banker actually had some gold and wanted to lend me the gold, he'd be lending me property for interest, which is prohibited by the scripture, but at least I'd be getting property. I'd be getting something. But the banker comes to me and he creates this money right out of thin air. He just writes out a promissory note. I sign it. He establishes an account in the bank and then says, here's the checkbook. Go out and buy your neighbor's horse. I can go out and buy all 10 of your horses, and now you've got $10,000. When we play cards, we call this old maid. And the last guy that gets hung with the old maid is the loser of the game. And that's the way it works with money. Money works the same way, and that's the inspiration for the game that we call the old maid. Americans today are holding all this debt. Americans today are holding the old maid. Americans today don't own cows and horses. They own computer chip. They own paper assets. They don't have physical possession of the gold. They have stocks and bonds that say that it's in a warehouse someplace, and I can go down and demand it anytime I want. Now, the problem with that is that if you took all the money in circulation and everybody in America did it at the same time and you all went into Walmart simultaneously and cashed it all in, you can get 2 cents on the dollar. That's all there is on the shelves, 2%. Looks like to me that if you have paper assets, you'd be better advised to go down and convert your paper assets into 100 cents on the dollar worth of goods and let the rest of the people out there take the loss, because that's ultimately the way that game is going to come out. All right, let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour. I'm your host, George Gordon. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived for your listening convenience on the Internet at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. You know, the income tax and Social Security programs are not compatible with our traditional American values, and that's because these two programs are the second and the eighth planks of the Communist Manifesto. These programs call for a heavy progressive income tax in place of tithing. Social Security is a social welfare scheme that takes the place of strict liability and individual responsibility. The income tax requires of us that we serve two masters in violation of Matthew 6, verse 24. The income tax requires of us that we rob God in violation of Malachi 3, verse 8. And this income tax requires of us that we commit idolatry in violation of Exodus 20, verse 3. The income tax requires that we use unjust weights and balances in violation of Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. And the income tax requires that we sign contracts with foreign and alien gods in violation of Exodus 23, verses 32 and 33. Social Security violates the strict liability statute in Exodus 21, verses 28 through 36. And Social Security violates the 10th commandment by appealing to our lust and greed. We call that income redistribution. The scripture calls it covetousness in violation of Exodus 20, verse 17. Now, you know, the God of Israel gave us a better way of life than that, and our founding fathers followed that better way in our federal constitution at Article 1, Section 10. And that's why I contend that you and I ought to learn how to practice that constitutional better way and that scriptural better way. If you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call me direct? It's 417-273-4967, and be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. Remember, it's entertaining, educational, informative, and it's free of charge. Tax and Status is also available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to my website, georgegordon.org, click on to the email, and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about Sheldon Emery's treatise on billions for the bankers and debts for the people. This program is entitled The National Debt. Now, our national debt is sitting at $7 trillion. It'll be $8 trillion by this time next year. Now, God also gave us another law. He said, you ought not to go surety for anybody else. You'll find that 6 times in the book of Proverbs. Surety is where you underwrite or guarantee somebody else's debt. Every time you endorse the back of a check, your endorsement is a surety guarantee. It violates the surety prohibition in the scripture. Well, after all, if you want to practice with unjust weights and balances, well then, you know, what's the big deal about going surety? What's the big deal about interest? So what happens here is that, first of all, we violate Leviticus 19, 35, and 36. Then we violate the usury statute. Then we violate the surety statute. So now we got three laws here that we're in violation of. Now, God didn't give you these three laws because he wanted to spoil a kid's fun. He told you not to do that because in the end, there's a penalty. There's a natural penalty that's going to occur, a natural phenomenon, and it's going to wipe you out. You see, when you work and you save, you'd like to come back later and spend your savings on something. Let's just try it for a minute. I have to go out and work to produce cattle. Now, I've got 20 or 30 head of cattle, and I've worked over the years, and I went out in the cold and the snow and the ice, and I fed them hay. And when they were calving, I carried the calves in, and I warmed them up, and I fed them on bottles, and I milked the cows, and I fed the cows, and I went out and I worked making hay, and I had to lift those heavy bales and put them on a wagon and put them in the barn and take them out of the barn and feed them to the cows, and I had to milk those cows every day. And when I was milking those cows every day, morning and night, I had to keep up that schedule, that regimen, and I couldn't go to Branson for dinner many nights because I had to stay home and milk. I had to get up early in the morning to milk my cows, sometimes before the sun came up. Now, all of that work, all of that labor came to fruition when I sold the milk and I sold the cow. And I converted that to gold and I put it in a hole in the ground. Now, when I get to be old and full of years, instead of drawing Social Security, I'm going to go with a shovel and draw on my gold reserves. This is the way Americans used to think. This is the way God ordered the program. And then Franklin Roosevelt came along and he said, you know, you shouldn't work that hard. The work is not for people like you. It's for blacks, Mexicans. It's for uneducated, public-schooled people. It's for everybody but smart people like you who go to college. And I was instructed that I should go to college and get an education so that I could be a professional. I could be a leader instead of a follower. And that I should use paper money. Now that's fine. If I were to do that and I went out and worked at my profession, let's call me a doctor, and I take my money, and instead of putting it in a hole in the ground, I put it in the bank. And let's suppose that I put $10,000 in the bank, and when I get to be old and full of years, I'm going to draw on that bank account. And I presume that the money that I'm drawing out from my bank account is going to buy the same number of loaves of bread and the same number of apples and oranges and the same number of pounds of meat that it would when I first earned it 60 years ago. But what we find in the real world is that the dollars that you earned 60 years ago and you put in the bank, today those dollars only buy 3.5 cents worth of goods and services. So you worked for an hour and you earned a dollar and it was going to buy 25 apples. But then when you actually got to be 65 and you took your dollar out of the bank, you couldn't get 25 apples. You could only get one apple. You lost 24 apples by saving it all those years. So the banker said, well, what we'll do is pay you interest to compound. Now, that sounds good. That sounds good. We're going to put our money in the bank and inflation will be offset by the interest. But the inflation rate from 1960 to 2000 was 4.5% per year, compounded annually. Now, if you take 4.5% and you compound that annually, you know, just take 72, divide that by 4.5, and it takes 16 years to double. So every 16 years, my money would double. So I put I put $100 in the bank in 1960, and in 1976, my $100 had grown to $200. Well, that's really great. Wow. That's fantastic. Now, during that same 16 years, my money was losing value. Say, my money was losing value at the rate of 4.5%, which just exactly canceled it out. So I didn't make anything, and I've got the same $100 in the bank, except now the $100 is called $200, but the prices that I now have to pay are double. Well, if that was the case, it wouldn't make any difference, because now I have the same amount of purchasing power that I had in 1960. So when I put the $100 in the bank, it's true the purchasing power was cut in half, but the interest that I received doubled the amount. So now I've got $200 to buy the same number of apples that I could have bought in 1960. If that was the case, that would be okay too, wouldn't it? Now, here's where the real world comes to play. In the real world, the purchasing power of your money goes down at 4.5% a year, and the interest that you receive on the money is paid to you in 1960 at the rate of 2%. Today, as I speak, interest rates are 1% or 2% at the bank. Inflation is running 8% to 10%. And the interest at the bank is 1% or 2%. And that's where reality is. So the $100 that you put in the bank over a period of 16 years now has the purchasing power of $50. But it now is called $200. But when you go out to spend your $200, it costs $225 or $250 to buy the same amount of goods that $100 would buy 16 years earlier. So you become a net loser of about 25% or 30 or 40 or 50% of the money that you save. And that's why savings in America is at an all-time low, only 1%. You see, people aren't dumb. All of you people have been born and bred in the briar patch of inflation, and you're smart enough to know that when you get paid today, you need to go out and spend that money today on something. So even if you go out and spend it on, oh, a trip to Disney World or whatever it is that may make you feel real good, you go out and spend that money. Maybe you buy a new car, or maybe you take a trip, or whatever, but you're not going to put it in the bank at 1% interest. And hey, your government knows that too. So the government teams up with Wall Street and corporations, and they say, hey, listen, how would you like to buy a piece of the rock? How would you like to get out here into the real world, roll up your sleeves, and get into trade, commerce, business, and industry, and invest in America? Why don't you buy General Electric and General Motors stock? And so that stock pays dividends. Well, in the old days, when I was a kid, that was a pretty good deal. I remember Russell Harvey. He told me that he got word that there was going to be a great economic depression back in 1927. So he sold all of his Transamerica stock. And he sold it for about $275 a share, not quite, I think it was $273, but in round numbers, it was $275, and he put the money in gold in a hole in the ground. He waited until 1935, now it was a long wait, 8 years, and everybody's laughing at him, making fun of him, and they said, you fool, you blind. And sure enough, the stock market from 1927 to 1928, 1929 continued to soar. I mean, it was just like the 1990s. People were just making money hand over fist in the stock market. At least they thought they were, until the market crashed, and then all those paper profits evaporated. But Russell Harvey didn't have his paper profits evaporate. He was one of those that cashed in, like Bernard Baruch and others of the insiders, and converted to hard money. And then in 1935, Transamerica had been bought up or merged with Bank of America, and he bought those shares for $5 a share, and in 1954 they were worth $53 a share. Hey, listen. Russell Harvey made a lot of money playing in the paper game. And you know, There are people that do make money playing in stocks and bonds and paper. You probably don't know the names of very many people that have done that. I just named for you the only man that I have ever met in my entire lifetime that ever made money in by the use of paper money. I know of others that have. John D. Rockefeller did, and I know that Bill Gates has so far. I don't know how it's going to work out, but if he cashed out today and converted that to gold, he could be a big winner. I suspect, though, he'll hang on to his paper until it becomes worthless. That's what most people do. You see, most people will take their labor, their real property, and they will invest that into stocks and bonds, and those stocks and bonds will go up in value. And then they will peak and decline, and then those people hang on to those stocks and bonds until they decline to where they're valued at what they paid for them or less, and then they sell them for a loss. That's about the way people invest in the markets. Now, they don't mean to do that, but they're not sophisticated and they don't understand paper money. They don't understand money at all because they've been educated in the public school system. And the public school system is not a place where you go to get an education. It's a place where you go to get indoctrinated. It's not a place where you go to learn how to think. It's a place where you go to learn to do what you're told. And we call that education. Well, it's the values of the system that are inculcated into the minds of the younger generation coming up. I call that brainwashing. The Russians call it psychopolitics. Now, remember, Sheldon Emery now says there's something inherently wrong in his little booklet here with this billions for the bankers and debts for the people. And he cites the Bible and he says, you know, that God had a different system. God had a better program than this. And we're being robbed. We're being lied to. We're being cheated. And we're being lied, robbed, and cheated by our own government. Yeah, well, God also told us about that, too. So let me digress for a moment. You know, the first commandment says, you shall have no other gods before me. And the second commandment is kind of like it. It says, you shall not worship, you know, fish and idols and paper money and state capitol buildings and statues of liberty. And we don't want you worshiping that. Well, if you take a look at this word worship, it's obedience to your master. Worship is obedience to your master. So people worship God. They just love God. And they're real religious, and about 65% of Americans go to church. And they get kind of teary-eyed, and they just want to go to church, and they just want to work for the Lord, and they want to do all these good things for God. Now, they don't want to obey God. I mean, they don't want to actually do what He tells them to do. Like, you know, you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. Now, we don't want to do that. We want $20 bills in our bag. And then where God says, you know, something like, you shall not let a garment of diverse sorts, such as linen and woolen, come upon you. Oh, no, we don't want to do that. We want to wear clothes with mixed fabrics, you know, about 85% cotton and 15% nylon, things like that. And then, you know, God comes along and says, don't practice usury and interest. And we say, oh, no, I want to sign a promissory note and pay 6% interest on this house and make a lot of money. Jesus one time made an observation. I think you'll find it over in about Luke 6:41 or Luke 6:44, something like that. And it says, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not the things which I say? In other words, why don't you do what I tell you? And that's because we're religious people, but when it comes to obedience, that's really not our cup of tea, that's really not our bag, and we're not really not too interested in doing that. So as a result of that, if you don't follow a law, is there a penalty for that? Is there something that comes up that penalizes you? For instance, what happens if we actually go out and practice usury and interest, and we use unjust weights and balances? And we do sign and go surety for other people. What happens to us if we do that? Is there some penalty? Well, the answer to that is an emphatic yes, there is. Yes, there is. The penalty for that is the loss of all of your property. So most of you out there, you've got boats and snow machines and houses and cars and stocks and bonds. You've got all these toys. And you're making payments on all these toys. And you've got a job. And you and your wife together are making $100,000 a year. And you're taking this money, this $100,000 a year, and you're paying payments every month on your cars, houses, stocks, bonds, and all of your furniture and all these kind of things. Now, the experience that we had back in the 1930s was this. If you lose your job and you don't have any money coming in, you can't make your payments. Now, just picture this. If we were to have a Great Depression of the early 21st century, you know, like 2004, if we had a Great Depression like we had in the 1930s and you lost your job, what would happen to your car? What would happen to your house? What would happen to your big screen TV and your furniture, stocks and bonds and all those things? Would you get wiped out? Would you lose everything you've got? Now let's try this. Let's suppose that years ago you bought a house worth $50,000. And let's suppose that that house today is worth $200,000, and today you owe $100,000 on that house. That means you get a 50% equity in the house. If you lose your job and you can't make the payments, the bank is going to take your house away from you and you're going to lose your $100,000 worth of equity. Now today, that equity in your house would buy about 100,000 loaves of Wonder Bread. So you're going to lose 100,000 loaves of Wonder Bread. And then the next thing is you're not going to have a roof over your head. You're going to be out living in your car or going back to live with mom and dad or, aren't you? Okay. Now let me give you a wild idea here. Let's suppose that you took this $100,000 house, you know, the $200,000 house that you have 100,000 equity in. Let's suppose that you sold that house tomorrow and you passed the old maid off to somebody else. Now they've got the old maid and probably they've got a $200,000 mortgage on this house. And you took the $100,000 and you converted that into gold. Now today at $400 an ounce, you'd get about 250 ounces of gold. So you get 250 ounces and you bury that in a hole in the ground. And sure enough, a collapse comes. And about 5 or 6 or 7 years from now, when this house can no longer be bought and sold at $200,000, its real cash value is going to come down to something. I don't know what it is, but I can remember back in 1927, houses were selling for $7,000. Well, my grandmother bought one of those $7,000 1927 houses in 1944 for $4,400. 1724 H Street in Eureka, California, sold for $4,400 in 1944. That house sold for $7,000 in 1927. So at the peak of the real estate bubble, and I might point out that that house was built in 1882 or 1884 for $1,000. So it was built for $1,000, and it was worth $7,000, ultimately sold for $4,400. Let's try that on this one here. The house is going to sell for about one half of what it sold for when there was a vibrant economy. So you could take your $100,000 out and go buy two houses after the recovery, couldn't you? Now, you've got a choice to make here. You can hang on to the house you've got with the debt against it and lose it all. Or you can sell it today and double your money in 8 years. That's a choice that you have to make. Because remember, you worked to create that $100,000 worth of equity. You've been making those payments on that house. See, you keep going down to the office and working. You keep going down to the mill and producing lumber or producing goods and services and products. And you bring a take-home pay check home and you make your house payments every month. You're actually taking your labor and converting it to that house. But unless the house is free and clear, you're always in jeopardy of losing everything. The worst case scenario is where you've made 359 payments on your house, lose your job, can't make the last payment, and lose it. That's the worst case scenario. Best case scenario is where you buy the house, put $5,000 down on it, you live in the house for 18 months, make your payments on it, and then you get kicked out of the house. You've just been paying your rent anyway, so you haven't lost anything. Or very, very little. And that's the choice that you have to make. Now, the bank makes money in two ways. The bank makes money when they lend you nothing for something. That is, when they create this $50,000 mortgage right out of thin air. They make $50,000 right off the top. You give them $5,000 down, so they only have $45,000 worth of exposure that they didn't pay anything for. They just took that and created it right out of thin air. You gave them $5,000, that's their profit up front, called the down payment. And then you got 360 payments at $300 a month on this $45,000. And every time you make a payment, even though the money is depreciating, that's total profit to the bank. 100% profit to the bank. Now, the best thing that can happen for the bank is that you pay for half of this house, which is 100% profit, and then you forfeit the house, and when we take the house back and we sell it to somebody else and do the same thing all over again. So the bank actually doubles their money when they can foreclose on the house that they lent you the money to buy. So the bank actually wants you to default so that they can foreclose. And right now we're on the verge of a gigantic deflation. And what it will be is a hyperinflation depression called stagflation. That's what we went through in 1973 and 74. Stagflation. Oh, it's immensely profitable for the bankers. And it's not really too bad for the government, because they'll be able to pay you Social Security recipients. They'll pay you. They'll send you a check every month. But instead of being able to buy a loaf of bread for each one of those dollars, pretty soon you'll get a half a loaf of bread for a dollar, then a quarter of a loaf of bread for a dollar, then a slice of bread for a dollar, and then pretty soon it'll be three crumbs of bread for a dollar. And that's what happens with hyperinflation. And that's what'll happen to you if you've got a house. It's what'll happen to you if you owe money on your car. You have to be free and clear. You have to be free and clear in everything that you've got. Because if you owe money on your house, but you're free and clear on the rest of your chattels, they'll take all of your chattels away from you in order to apply that to the debt that you owe on the house. All right, boys and girls, we're about out of time here for lesson one. So hang on, we'll take our break here and we'll be back tomorrow night, same time, same station, with more on the national debt. We're talking about more on money. Sheldon Emery's book on billions for the bankers and debts for the people, when we take this up right here next time. Now keep in mind that the Law Hour is brought to you by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And if you'd like more information on the Law Hour and the Law School, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and we're on KU Band Radio on Telstar 5. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for easy reference. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, medicine, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. Well, there's the signal. It says our time is up, so we're going to have to leave it right there. I'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing. So until then, good night, friends.